Welcome to the Universal Podcast Network. One voice, everywhere.
Hi, I'm Daniel Lukis.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101, where sound, story, and history come together to shape the music we know today. Another week, another great episode. America sang before it forgot who it was. Music, masculinity, love, and loss of cultural memory, part two.
Yes, and part one, when we saw that every culture writes itself into song before it writes itself into history. The ballads come first, before the constitutions, before the manifestos, before the monuments. In America, that truth runs deeper than almost anywhere else on earth, because this nation was invented, conceived in revolution, forged in contradiction, and held together by ideals and ambition, producing a spectacular set of stories we agreed to sing. For 250 years, Americans have been singing their way toward a self they haven't quite finished building. In conclusion, we're going to cover a lot of ground, so buckle in.
Indeed, buckle in, people, and Mr. Mick, America sang before it forgot who it was. Music, masculinity, love, and the loss of cultural memory. So
let's move into century. Because there's a chapter that's two world wars and the depression between them that reshapes American masculinity in ways the music captures like nothing else. So we start with George M. Cohan on a train in 1917, which is the most American origin story imaginable. Cohan, playwright, composer, actor, the man who effectively owned Broadway in his era, was riding a train after reading the newspaper announcement that Congress had declared war on Germany. And by the time he arrived at his destination, he had written "Over There" entirely in his head. He was the son of Irish immigrants, a vaudeville performer since early childhood, and he understood instinctively how to write a song that could mobilize a nation. The song is brisk, confident, almost cartoonishly simple. The Yanks are coming. The drums are rum-tum-tumming, and that's all you need to know. Enrico Caruso recorded it. Nora Baines performed it in theaters across the country. The U.S. government deployed it as a recruitment tool. Cohan received the Congressional Gold Medal for it in 1936, one of only a handful of civilians ever so honored. James Cagney played Cohan in the 1942 film Yankee Doodle Dandy and won the Academy Award for it. The whole production arriving just in time to do for World War II what the song had done for the first one. The masculinity of Over There is pure Teddy Roosevelt, muscular, outward-facing, certain of its moral authority, free of ambiguity or doubt. The Yanks are coming, and that is simply unambiguously good. There is no irony in Cohan. In 1917, that absence of irony was historically plausible. Most Americans genuinely believed the war would be swift, just, and definitively won. The veterans who came home from the Western Front having lived through the trenches, the chlorine gas and the industrial slaughter on the Somme and the Verdun knew better, but their knowledge had not yet filtered into popular song. The knowledge arrived a decade later through the grinding humiliation of the Depression. "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" was written by lyricist E.Y. Yip Harburg and composer Jay Corney in 1931, when unemployment had reached roughly 25%. And the men who had been told their sacrifice would be rewarded were standing in bread lines outside the same cities that had marched through to fanfare 14 years earlier. Harburg was the son of Russian Jewish immigrants who grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan and lost everything he had in the 1929 crash. The song was narrated by a veteran, a man who built the railroads, farmed the prairies, fought in France, believed every word of the American promise, who is now destitute and bewildered. The word "brother" is doing enormous work in that lyric. It is both a plea to a literal passerby and a theological invocation of human solidarity. The New Testament fraternity of men who owed each other something beyond market transactions. In conclusion, "Over There" and "Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?" are there before and after the American 20th century. The muscular confidence of a nation going to war and the broken bewilderment of the same nation coming home to poverty. And the distance between those two songs is the distance between the American mythology and the American reality.
Okay, Mr. Mink, I want to shift to something more intimate. There is a whole tradition of American songs that are really love songs to places, not a romantic love between people, but this is an aching, almost unbearable longing for a specific geography. What is going on to the psychologically?
You have put your finger on something absolutely central to American emotional life, and it connects to what the sociologist Robert Bella called civil religion, the way Americans substitute attachments to place and region for the kind of ethnic and ancestral rootedness that other cultures carry across generations. When you do not have centuries of family burial grounds in a single location, when your grandparents may have come from six different countries, the land itself becomes the repository of identity and memory, and nowhere is that more achingly true than in the American South. Georgia on My Mind was written in 1930 by the Indiana-born composer Hoagy Carmichael, with lyrics by his college friend Stuart Gorel. The song is deliberately ambiguous. Georgia could be the state or a woman, and Carmichael himself said Gorel wrote it about a girlfriend named Georgia, while others maintained it was always about the state. The ambiguity is generative. It means the song can carry both registers simultaneously. The longing for a woman and the longing for a homeland became the same longing, which says something true about how human attachment works. Eventually, the song was named the official song of Georgia. Interestingly, the man who had been banned from performing it there for insisting that the Democratic Party Jim Crow South should drop its restrictions deserved to sit with anyone at his concerts was now the state's official musical voice. That arc, the wound, the defiance, the reconciliation, the official embrace, is American history in miniature. And it is no coincidence that the vehicle for all this was a love song. Take Me Home, Country Roads operates in the same emotional register, though its origins are more complicated than its apparent simplicity suggests. The song was co-written in 1971 by Bill Danoff, Taffy Nivert, and John Denver. Danoff has said the road is a song based on Clopper Road in Montgomery County, Maryland, not West Virginia at all. Denver, born Henry John Duschendorf, the Jr. in Roswell, New Mexico, had never spent significant time in West Virginia before recording it. And yet, West Virginia adapted the song as one of its official state songs in 2014. And the stadium at WVU football games reverberates with it as though it descended from the mountains on stone tablets. In conclusion, when Americans sing about places, they are almost always singing about a home they never quite had or could no longer return to. Which is why the geography of American popular music is always, beneath its surface specificity, a map of loss.
Mr. Mick, I want to talk about love and fidelity, because I think when people think of country music and masculinity, they think of either drinking or heartbreak or a swagger and trucks. But there's a difference. Strain one that is actually about commitment. Where does that show up most powerfully?
It shows up most powerfully and most unexpectedly in Johnny Cash, and specifically in I Walk the Line from 1956, which is contemporaneous with the birth of rock and roll and is, on the surface, one of the most peculiar hit records ever made. Let me give you the mechanics first, because they are inseparable from the meaning. Cash wrote the song as a fidelity pledge to his first wife, Vivian Liberto, while he was on the road and feeling the pressures that life on tour inevitably brings. He reportedly told producer Sam Phillips that the song was his thesis statement, his commitment to keeping himself in line. The musical structure mirrors this content with startling precision. Each verse modulates to a new key, moving up and forths, and Cash hums the new tonic pitch at the beginning of each verse to orient himself. You can hear the humming clearly in the recording if you listen for it. He is literally walking himself back to the right key, the right center, the right home. The form performs the content. The theologian James K.A. Smith, in his book, You Are What You Love, argues that character is formed by repeated practices, what he calls liturgies, that orient our desires toward what we actually value. Cash's song is a description of exactly such a masculine liturgy. Walking the line is not a one-time decision. It is a daily recommitment, renewed at each verse, reoriented at each new key. The hummed pitch at the beginning of every stanza is Cash checking in with his own center, asking, am I still here? Am I still true? The terrible irony, of course, is that Cash did not ultimately walk the line with Vivian. His addiction to amphetamines, his affairs, and his generally unraveling in the early 1960s led to their divorce in 1966. He married June Carter in 1968 and spent the rest of his life framing that relationship as his redemption, which it was in the complicated way that human redemption usually works. But the song predates all that, and it captures a moment of genuine aspiration, a man trying to construct himself into someone worthy of what he loves, building into his music the scaffolding of the self he wants to become. That aspiration, even unfulfilled, is not trivial, is the beginning of something. For male listeners especially, I Walk the Line offers something rare in American popular music, permission to admit vulnerability as a precondition of faithfulness rather than its opposite. The strong man in this song is not the man who never feels temptation. He is the man who knows he does, watches himself for it, and builds his days around it, not yielding to it. That is a more honest and a more demanding model of masculine virtue than the invulnerable hero. And it resonates precisely because it describes the experience of being human. In conclusion, I Walk the Line is a theology of daily fidelity, the argument that love is not a feeling that persists on its own, but a practice that must be chosen each day again. And the willingness to be honest about your own capacity for failure is not the end of trustworthiness, but its most essential beginning.
Mr. McWitt, talk about the civil rights movement, because I think this is the moment in American history when music stopped being an accompaniment or accompaniment to political action and actually becomes a political action itself. How do you explain and what happens there?
What happens is that the American church tradition, built over two centuries of slavery, survival, and coded resistance in the spirituals, meets the moment it was always preparing for. The civil rights movement is incomprehensible without its music, and not just as inspiration or morale building. The songs were organizing tools, communication infrastructure, and acts of courage in themselves. Singing We Shall Overcome at a sit-in while men poured ketchup on your head and cigarette ash into your hair was not a sentimental gesture. It was an act of radical, nonviolent aggression, a refusal to be provoked, a demonstration of moral superiority, and a communal assertion that the movement's foundation was too deep to be reached by temporary humiliation. We Shall Overcome has a layered history that mirrors the movement itself. Its roots are in the American gospel tradition, specifically a hymn, I'll Overcome Someday, composed by Charles Albert Tinley, a Methodist minister and son of a formerly enslaved man, published in 1900. It moved through the labor movement singing in the 1940s. Pete Seeger encountered it and helped adapt it to the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, the extraordinary institution that trained both Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr. in nonviolent resistance before either of them became famous. By the time the song became the anthem of the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955, and then the broader movement through the 1960s, it carried all of that history in its bones. What is remarkable about We Shall Overcome is its tense, not we have overcome, not we are overcoming, but we shall overcome. A future tense claim made in the present moment, in the face of present suffering, staking everything on a promise that has not yet been materialized. That is the grammar of biblical hope, the same grammar as the Hebrew prophets, the same grammar as the Battle Hymn of the Republic, but now directed not as an enemy army, but at the moral conscience of the nation itself. Lyndon Johnson used the phrase, we shall overcome, before a joint session of Congress in March 1965, introducing the Voting Rights Act, and by all accounts, several civil rights leaders watching on television wept, not with triumph, but with the complicated emotion of hearing your deepest convictions spoken back to you from the highest office in the land. In conclusion, the music of the civil rights era demonstrates that song is not merely the accompaniment to American history, but one of its primary instruments. That the decision to keep singing in the face of violence is itself a form of argument that no legislation can fully capture and no oppressor has ever successfully silenced.
Mr. Meek, now we come to Vietnam because this is when American music starts doing something it had never quite done before in the mainstream. Considering youth and protest music, how do we make sense of that shift?
The shift is best understood not as a departure from American identity, but as an intensification of one of its oldest strains, the anti-elite populism that goes all the way back to Yankee Doodle. What happens in the Vietnam era is that this strain, which had been expressed in folk music, blues, and early country for decades, suddenly becomes the dominant language of mainstream popular culture. And no song captures the moment more precisely than Fortunate Son by Creedence Clearwater Revival, released in November 1969. John Fogerty wrote the song in direct response to the manifest unfairness of Vietnam-era draft exemptions. The children of the wealthy and the politically connected, senators' sons, businessmen's sons, children of privilege, were disappearing into college deferments, medical deferments, and National Guard slots. The children of the poor and the working class were going to Southeast Asia in their place. Fogerty himself was drafted into the Army Reserve. He had watched friends and neighbors get shipped off while others were protected by connections their families had spent generations cultivating. The direct inspiration, he has said in multiple interviews, was learning that David Eisenhower, grandson of President Eisenhower and fiancé of Julie Nixon, daughter of the sitting president, had joined the Navy Reserve. Another fortunate son, safe behind the gates. In conclusion, Fortunate Son is the sound of the American working class discovering that the promise of equal sacrifice is conditional, and that this discovery is not the end of patriotism, but painfully and necessarily one of its most mature expressions.
Mr. Merck, born in the USA, might be the most fascinating case I know of the song that gets almost universally misread. Walk us through that. What is actually happening in that song? Because most people seem to hear it was the first pumping celebration, and it's clearly not that.
It is almost exactly the opposite of that, and the story of its misreading is itself one of the most revealing cultural documents of the Reagan era. Let me start with the music, because the music is the trap. Bruce Springsteen recorded Born in the USA in 1982, though it was not released until 1984. The arrangement that ended up on the album features a massive arenas-ready synthesizer riff by Roy Bittan, a thundering Max Weinberg drum pattern, and Springsteen's voice mixed to cut through the wall of sound like a battle cry. It sounds triumphant. It sounds enormous. It sounds like the kind of song you would play at a rally. Now listen to the lyrics with your full attention. The narrator is a Vietnam veteran from a working-class town who got into legal trouble and was sent to Vietnam as an alternative to jail, a common enough pattern in that era. According to one family story, one of my uncles joined the Air Force and served in Germany for a similar transgression. In Springsteen's case, he went to fight the yellow man, came back, found his brother killed in action, could not get work, couldn't get help from the Veterans Administration, finds himself at the end of the line with nowhere to go and no one to call. The chorus, Born in the USA, is not a celebration. It is a howl of bitter irony, the way a convicted man might recite his sentence. I was born here. This country made me, and look what it did to me. Springsteen had recorded an earlier acoustic version of the song. You can hear it on the track's box set and in various live recordings that makes the devastation unmistakable. Stripped of the sonic spectacle, it is a lament, almost a folk song in the Woody Guthrie tradition, and the wound in Springsteen's voice is impossible to miss. The problem is that Springsteen chose it to dress it in the costume of triumph, and the American ears of 1984, at the peak of Reaganite optimism, heard the costume and not the body inside it. The music critic Simon Frith has written in Performing Rights about how anthemic sound functions as a kind of override on lyrical content. The body responds to the beat before the mind processes the words. And if the beat says triumph, much of the audience will hear triumph regardless of what the words say. What is clear is that Born in the USA gives us the same betrayed working-class man as Fortunate Son, but where Fogerty's man is still angry and fighting, Springsteen's man is exhausted. He has passed anger into something closer to devastation. He was born in this country. He served this country. He came home to find it had no use for him. That is not a political slogan. That is a wound that has been open for 40 years. In conclusion, Born in the USA is a Rorschach test for American self-knowledge, and the fact that it became the defining anthem of a presidential campaign season while being a song about an abandoned veteran is not merely ironic. It is the most revealing truth about how American political culture processes inconvenient realities.
Mr. Mink, we have to close with the South because we've been circling it all episode. Sweet Home Alabama is one of the most politically charged songs in American rock history and, well, simultaneously one of the most beloved. How do you hold those two things together?
With difficulty and with honesty, which is the only way to hold most things in American music together. The full context is genuinely complex, and it deserves to be given whole rather than the flattened version that both defenders and critics tend to reach for. Lynyrd Skynyrd released Sweet Home Alabama in 1974. The song was written primarily by Ronnie Van Zant and Ed King as an explicit response to Neil Young's 1970 song Southern Man, which depicted the South as a land of racist violence and unreconstructed white supremacy. Young's song, however sincere its moral purpose, painted with a very broad brush. The South is a monolith of guilt with no internal variation, no complexity, no working class people who had themselves been economically exploited by the same Democratic Party. Van Zant and the band push back directly, and the song opens with an address to Young by name. Well, I hope Neil Young will remember. A Southern man don't need him around anyhow. Neil Young, to his enduring credit, has said publicly that he deserved the criticism, has praised the song warmly, and has maintained genuine affection for the Skynyrd legacy. His generosity on this point is noble and admirable. What is unambiguous is the emotional content of the rest of the song, a full-throated, unapologetic love for the South as a place, a culture, a musical inheritance. The guitar riffs borrowed from the tradition of Southern rock and blues, the sheer physical pleasure of the rhythm section, the casual ease of the imagery, all of it performs a pride of place that was, in the early 1970s, a genuine act of cultural defiance against a dominant coastal media narrative that had decided Southern meant backward, Southern meant racist, Southern meant over and done with. Gary Hartman, writing in The History of Texas Music, notes that the Southern rock movement of the 1970s was, among other things, a working-class cultural movement that refused to accept condescension from liberal elites, a dynamic with unmistakable parallels to Yankee Doodle reclamation two centuries earlier. The Southern sentiment and working-class ethos of the downtrodden is perhaps best expressed by the rebellious Merle Haggard in Okie from Muskogee. Haggard unapologetically celebrated Middle America and defiantly held on to Southern values and patriotism despite the uncool character of the song. In conclusion, Southern working-class song showed the sound of a region asserting its right to be loved without being idealized, and its enduring hold of American audiences across every demographic line suggests that the hunger for that kind of particular, complicated, unsentimental love, the love that sees clearly and still claims, is something that crosses every boundary we draw on the American map.
Well said, Mr. Mink. As we wind down, what is the thread that ties these American songs together in a nation that celebrates Pluribus Unum out of many one?
If there's a thread that runs through all of these songs, from Yankee Doodle to Born in the USA, from the spirituals of the enslaved to Ray Charles' Weeping for Georgia, from Julia Ward Howe's Apocalyptic Dawn to Johnny Cash humming himself back to the right key, it is this. Americans have always understood, even when they could not articulate it in any other form, that the country is exceptional. Every one of these songs lives in the space between what America is and what America aspires to be. Not one of them is purely celebratory. Not one of them is purely condemning. They hold the tension because the tension is the truth. It would be awesome to have a 250th anniversary song similar to what the Ohio Players did in 1976 with their song Bicentennial. The lyrics are unifying. Join the race. Save this place. We must keep the faith. Bicentennial is touching and sincere. The chorus of Bicentennial is, let's make a friend, y'all. Love your mother, trust your brother, have faith in one another sounds genuinely American to me. The masculinity embedded in these songs refuses the simplicity of every dominant cultural narrative, both the old mythology of the invulnerable hero and the more recent argument that masculinity itself is the problem. What we find instead is a much richer catalog. The self-mocking revolutionary of Yankee Doodle, the vigilant faithful husband of I Walk the Line, the betrayed enlisted man of Fortunate Son, the devastated veteran of Born in the USA, the exile who cannot stop dreaming of Georgia, the Civil War soldier walking into Howe's Divine Harvest, the Depression breadline veteran asking his country to remember him. These are men who know their limits, who feel the gap between who they are and what who they meant to be, and who make their music from inside that gap. That is not weakness, that is depth. And depth is what separates a song that lasts from a song that charts. The love in these songs, love of person, love of place, love of country, is never clean. It is always complicated by history, by disappointment, by the knowledge that the thing you love has done and will do things that break your heart. Ray Charles was banned from Georgia and then made its anthem. Springsteen's veteran was abandoned by the country he served and still announced himself as its son. Guthrie loved this land so much he couldn't stop interrogating it. Julia Ward Howe watched men march to their deaths, singing her words and believed with everything in her that their deaths meant something. That kind of love, the love that sees clearly and still commits, the love that knows the full record and still shows up, is perhaps the most distinctly American contribution to the American emotional catalog and to the human catalog. It is the love that says, I know what you are. In conclusion, 250 years of American music and what they all aspire to is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the long, difficult, irreplaceable practice of inspiring the world that America is the light of the world.
America's song before it forgot, and who it was, Mr. Meg, music, masculinity, love, and loss of a cultural memories, will continue a powerful exploration of how music once carried the stories, values, struggles, and dreams of a nation. This compelling episode examines the changing meaning of masculinity, the fading language of enduring love, and the cultural memories preserved within the songs of earlier generations. So, Mr. Meg, would you like to plug in something?
I appreciate the opportunity. Write the book, grow the business, connect with me on LinkedIn, listen to the Doctor of Digital podcast, pick up a couple of volumes I have on Amazon. That's On Track, Ian Hunter, and Burning America.
Yes, people, let's support Mr. Meg, the Doctor of Digital, and of course, our 101s, Music 101, Mental Health 101, and of course, Sex 101. And you can listen wherever you listen your podcast. Please do visit our official website of all the podcasts that we're creating, www.universalpodcast.net. So, Mr. Mink, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, my friend. Until next time, Deus Vault.
Morning, people. See you soon.
Thank you for joining us on the Universal Podcast Network. One voice, everywhere.